Croningsfield, and that he was the bastard son of a merchant seaman and a London barmaid. There had been many clues before then that Gordon Gordon was a con man, but his initial act of honesty and support had so blinded Gould that it took the loss of millions for him to see through the scheme. A single act of honesty is often not enough. What is required is a reputation for honesty, built on a series of acts. But these can be quite inconsequential. Once this reputation is established, as with first impressions, it is hard to shake. In ancient China, Duke Wu of Cheng decided it was time to take over the increasingly powerful kingdom of Hu. Telling no one of his plan, he married his daughter to Hu's ruler. He then called a council and asked his ministers, "I am considering a military campaign. Which country should we invade?" As he had expected, one of his ministers replied, "Who should be invaded?" The duke seemed angry and said, "Who is a sister state now? Why do you suggest invading her?" He had the minister executed for his impolitic remark. The ruler of Hu heard about this, and considering other tokens of Wu's honesty and the marriage with his daughter, he took no precautions to defend himself from Cheng. A few weeks later, Cheng forces swept through Hu and took the country, never to relinquish it. Honesty is one of the best ways to disarm the wary, but it is not the only one. Any kind of noble, apparently selfless act will serve. Perhaps the best such act, though, is one of generosity. Few people can resist a gift, even from the most hardened enemy, which is why it is often the perfect way to disarm people. A gift brings out the child in us, instantly lowering our defenses. Although we often view other people's actions in the most cynical light, we rarely see the Machiavellian element of a gift, which quite often hides ulterior motives. A gift is the perfect object in which to hide a deceptive move. Over 3,000 years ago, the ancient Greeks traveled across the sea to recapture the beautiful Helen, stolen away from them by Paris, and to destroy Paris's city, Troy. The siege lasted 10 years. Many heroes died, yet neither side had come close to victory. One day the prophet Calchas assembled the Greeks. "Stop battering at these walls," he told them. "You must find some other way, some ruse. We cannot take Troy by force alone. We must find some cunning stratagem." The cunning Greek leader, Odysseus, came up with the idea of building a giant wooden horse, hiding soldiers inside it, then offering it to the Trojans as a gift. Neoptolemus, son of Achilles, was disgusted with this idea. It was unmanly. Better for thousands to die on the battlefield than to gain victory so deceitfully. But the soldiers, faced with a choice between another 10 years of manliness, honor, and death, on the one hand, and a quick victory on the other, chose the horse, which was promptly built. The trick was successful, and Troy fell. One gift did more for the Greek cause than 10 years of fighting. Selective kindness should also be a part of your arsenal of deception. For years, the ancient Romans had besieged the city of the Faliscans, always unsuccessfully. One day, however, when the Roman general Camillus was encamped outside the city, he suddenly saw a man leading some children toward him. The man was a Faliscan teacher, and the children, it turned out, were the sons and daughters of the noblest and wealthiest citizens of the town. On the pretense of taking his children out for a walk, he had led them straight to the Romans, offering them as hostages in hopes of ingratiating himself with Camillus, the city's enemy. Camillus did not take the children hostage. He stripped the teacher, tied his hands behind his back, gave each child a rod, and let them whip him all the way back to the city. The gesture had an immediate effect on the Faliscans. Had Camillus used the children as hostages, some in the city would have voted to surrender. And even if the Faliscans had gone on fighting, the resistance would have been half-hearted. Camillus's refusal to take advantage of the situation broke down the Faliscans' resistance, and they surrendered. The general had calculated correctly. And in any case, he had nothing to lose. He knew that the hostage ploy would not have ended the war, at least not right away. By turning the situation around, he earned his enemies' trust and respect, disarming them. Selective kindness will often break down even the most stubborn foe. Aiming right for the heart, it corrodes the will to fight back. Remember, by playing on people's emotions, calculated acts of kindness can turn a Capone into a gullible child. As with any emotional approach, the tactic must be practiced with caution. If people see through it, their disappointed feelings of gratitude and warmth will become the most violent hatred and distrust. Unless you can make the gesture seem sincere and heartfelt, do not play with fire. Reversal. When you have a history of deceit behind you, no amount of honesty, generosity, or kindness will fool people. In fact, it will only call attention to itself. Once people have come to see you as deceitful, to act honest all of a sudden is simply suspicious. In these cases, it is better to play the rogue. Count Lustig, pulling the biggest con of his career, was about to sell the Eiffel Tower to an unsuspecting industrialist who believed the government was auctioning it off for scrap metal. The industrialist was prepared to hand over a huge sum of money to Lustig, who had successfully impersonated a government official. At the last minute, however, the mark was suspicious. Something about Lustig bothered him. At the meeting in which he was to hand over the money, Lustig sensed his sudden distrust. Leaning over to the industrialist, Lustig explained in a low whisper how low his salary was, how difficult his finances were, and on and on. After a few minutes of this, the industrialist realized that Lustig was asking for a bribe. For the first time, he relaxed. Now he knew he could trust Lustig. Since all government officials were dishonest, Lustig had to be real. The man forked over the money. By acting dishonest, Lustig seemed the real McCoy. In this case, selective honesty would have had the opposite effect. As the French diplomat Talleyrand grew older, his reputation as a master liar and deceiver spread. At the Congress of Vienna, 1814 to 1815, he would spin fabulous stories and make impossible remarks to people who knew he had to be lying. His dishonesty had no purpose except to cloak the moments when he really was deceiving them. One day, for example, among friends, Talleyrand said with apparent sincerity, "In business one ought to show one's hand." No one who heard him could believe their ears. A man who never once in his life had shown his cards was telling other people to show theirs. Tactics like this made it impossible to distinguish Talleyrand's real deceptions from his fake ones. By embracing his reputation for dishonesty, he preserved his ability to deceive. Nothing in the realm of power is set in stone. Overt deceptiveness will sometimes cover your tracks, even making you admired for the honesty of your dishonesty. From The Power of the Charlatan by Grete De Francesco. Francesco Borri, Courtier Charlatan. Francesco Giuseppe Borri of Milan, whose death in 1695 fell just within the 17th century, was a forerunner of that special type of charlatanical adventurer, the courtier or cavalier impostor. His real period of glory began after he moved to Amsterdam. There he assumed the title of Medico Universale, maintained a great retinue, and drove about in a coach with 6 horses. Patients streamed to him, and some invalids had themselves carried in sedan chairs all the way from Paris to his place in Amsterdam. Borri took no payment for his consultations. He distributed great sums among the poor and was never known to receive any money through the post or bills of exchange. As he continued to live with such splendor, nevertheless, it was presumed that he possessed the philosopher's stone. Suddenly, this benefactor disappeared from Amsterdam. Then it was discovered that he had taken with him money and diamonds that had been placed in his charge. The 13th Law. When asking for help, appeal to people's self-interest, never to their mercy or gratitude. If you need to turn to an ally for help, do not bother to remind him of your past assistance and good deeds. He will find a way to ignore you. Instead, uncover something in your request or in your alliance with him that will benefit him, and emphasize it out of all proportion. He will respond enthusiastically when he sees something to be gained for himself. transgression of the law. In the early 14th century, a young man named Castruccio Castracani rose from the rank of common soldier to become lord of the great city of Lucca, Italy. One of the most powerful families in the city, the Poggios, had been instrumental in his climb, which succeeded through treachery and bloodshed. But after he came to power, they came to feel he had forgotten them. His ambition outweighed any gratitude he felt. In 1325, while Castruccio was away fighting Lucca's main rival, Florence, the Poggios conspired with other noble families in the city to rid themselves of this troublesome and ambitious prince. Mounting an insurrection, the plotters attacked and murdered the governor, whom Castruccio had left behind to rule the city. Riots broke out, and the Castruccio supporters and the Poggio supporters were poised to do battle. At the height of the tension, however, Stefano di Poggio, the oldest member of the family, intervened and made both sides lay down their arms. A peaceful man, Stefano had not taken part in the conspiracy. He told his family it would end in a useless bloodbath. Now he insisted he should intercede on the family's behalf and persuade Castruccio to listen to their complaints and satisfy their demands. Stefano was the oldest and wisest member of the clan, and his family agreed to put their trust in his diplomacy rather than in their weapons. When news of the rebellion reached Castruccio, he hurried back to Lucca. By the time he arrived, however, the fighting had ceased through Stefano's agency, and he was surprised by the city's calm and peace. Stefano di Poggio had imagined that Castruccio would be grateful to him for his part in quelling the rebellion, so he paid the prince a visit. He explained how he had brought peace, then begged for Castruccio's mercy. He said that the rebels and his family were young and impetuous, hungry for power, yet inexperienced. He recalled his family's past generosity to Castruccio. For all these reasons, he said, the great prince should pardon the Poggios and listen to their complaints. This, he said, was the only just thing to do, since the family had willingly laid down their arms and had always supported him. Castruccio listened patiently. He seemed not the slightest bit angry or resentful. Instead, he told Stefano to rest assured that justice would prevail, and he asked him to bring his entire family to the palace to talk over their grievances and come to an agreement. As they took leave of one another, Castruccio said he thanked God for the chance he had been given to show his clemency and kindness. That evening, the entire Poggio family came to the palace. Castruccio immediately had them imprisoned, and a few days later, all were executed, including Stefano. Interpretation. Stefano di Poggio is the embodiment of all those who believe that the justice and nobility of their cause will prevail. Certainly appeals to justice and gratitude have occasionally succeeded in the past, but more often than not, they have had dire consequences, especially in dealings with the Castruccios of the world. Stefano knew that the prince had risen to power through treachery and ruthlessness. This was a man, after all, who had put a close and devoted friend to death. When Castruccio was told that it had been a terrible wrong to kill such an old friend, he replied that he had executed not an old friend, but a new enemy. A man like Castruccio knows only force and self-interest. When the rebellion began, to end it and place oneself at his mercy was the most dangerous possible move. Even once Stefano di Poggio had made that fatal mistake, however, he still had options. He could have offered money to Castruccio, could have made promises for the future, could have pointed out what the Poggios could still contribute to Castruccio's power. Their influence with the most influential families of Rome, for example, and the great marriage they could have brokered. Instead, Stefano brought up the past and debts that carried no obligation. Not only is a man not obliged to be grateful, gratitude is often a terrible burden that he gladly discards. And in this case, Castruccio rid himself of his obligations to the Poggios by eliminating the Poggios. Observance of the law. In 433 B.C., just before the Peloponnesian War, the island of Corcyra, later called Corfu, and the Greek city-state of Corinth stood on the brink of conflict. Both parties sent ambassadors to Athens to try to win over the Athenians to their side. The stakes were high, since whoever had Athens on his side was sure to win. And whoever won the war would certainly give the defeated side no mercy. Corcyrus spoke first. Its ambassador began by admitting that the island had never helped Athens before, and in fact had allied itself with Athens' enemies. There were no ties of friendship or gratitude between Corcyra and Athens. Yes, the ambassador admitted, he had come to Athens now out of fear and concern for Corcyra's safety. The only thing he could offer was an alliance of mutual interests. Corcyra had a navy only surpassed in size and strength by Athens' own. An alliance between the two states would create a formidable force, one that could intimidate the rival state of Sparta. That, unfortunately, was all Corcyra had to offer. The representative from Corinth, then, gave a brilliant, passionate speech in sharp contrast to the dry, colorless approach of the Corcyran. He talked of everything Corinth had done for Athens in the past. He asked how it would look to Athens' other allies if the city put an agreement with a former enemy over one with a present friend, one that had served Athens' interest loyally. Perhaps those allies would break their agreements with Athens if they saw that their loyalty was not valued. He referred to Hellenic law and the need to repay Corinth for all its good deeds. He finally went on to list the many services Corinth had performed for Athens and the importance of showing gratitude to one's friends. After the speech, the Athenians debated the issue in an assembly. On the second round, they voted overwhelmingly to ally with Corcyra and drop Corinth. Interpretation. History has remembered the Athenians nobly, but they were the preeminent realists of classical Greece. With them, all the rhetoric, all the emotional appeals in the world could not match a good pragmatic argument, especially one that added to their power. What the Corinthian ambassador did not realize was that his references to Corinth's past generosity to Athens only irritated the Athenians, subtly asking them to feel guilty and putting them under obligation. The Athenians couldn't care less about past favors and friendly feelings. At the same time, they knew that if other allies thought them ungrateful for abandoning Corinth, these city-states would still be unlikely to break their ties to Athens, the preeminent power in Greece. Athens ruled its empire by force, and would simply compel any rebellious ally to return to the fold. When people choose between talk about the past and talk about the future, a pragmatic person will always opt for the future and forget the past. As the Corcyrans realized, it is always best to speak pragmatically to a pragmatic person. And in the end, most people are, in fact, pragmatic. They will rarely act against their own self-interest. Keys to power. In your quest for power, you will constantly find yourself in the position of asking for help from those more powerful than you. There is an art to asking for help, an art that depends on your ability to understand the person you are dealing with and to not confuse your needs with theirs. Most people never succeed at this because they are completely trapped in their own wants and desires. They start from the assumption that the people they are appealing to have a selfless interest in helping them. They talk as if their needs mattered to these people, who probably couldn't care less. Sometimes they refer to larger issues, a great cause, or grand emotions, such as love and gratitude. They go for the big picture when simple, everyday realities would have much more appeal. What they don't realize is that even the most powerful person is locked inside needs of his own, and that if you make no appeal to his self-interest, he merely sees you as desperate, or, at best, a waste of time. In the 16th century, Portuguese missionaries tried for years to convert the people of Japan to Catholicism, while at the same time Portugal had a monopoly on trade between Japan and Europe. Although the missionaries did have some success, they never got far among the ruling elite. By the beginning of the 17th century, in fact, their proselytizing had completely antagonized the Japanese emperor, Ieyasu. When the Dutch began to arrive in Japan in great numbers, Ieyasu was much relieved. He needed Europeans for their know-how in guns and navigation, and here at last were Europeans who cared nothing for spreading religion. The Dutch wanted only to trade. Ieyasu swiftly moved to evict the Portuguese. From then on, he would only deal with the practical-minded Dutch. Japan and Holland were vastly different cultures, but each shared a timeless and universal concern: self-interest. Every person you deal with is like another culture, an alien land with a past that has nothing to do with yours. Yet you can bypass the differences between you and him by appealing to his self-interest. Do not be subtle. You have valuable knowledge to share. You will fill his coffers with gold. You will make him live longer and happier. This is the language that all of us speak and understand. A key step in the process is to understand the other person's psychology. Is he vain? Is he concerned about his reputation or his social standing? Does he have enemies you could help him vanquish? Is he simply motivated by money and power? When the Mongols invaded China in the 12th century, they threatened to obliterate a culture that had thrived for over 2,000 years. Their leader, Genghis Khan, saw nothing in China but a country that lacked pasturing for his horses, and he decided to destroy the place, leveling all its cities, for it would be better to exterminate the Chinese and let the grass grow. It was not a soldier, a general, or a king who saved the Chinese from devastation, but a man named Yelu Chuzi. A foreigner himself, Chuzi had come to appreciate the superiority of Chinese culture. He managed to make himself a trusted advisor of Genghis Khan, and persuaded him that he would reap riches out of the place if, instead of destroying it, he simply taxed everyone who lived there. Khan saw the wisdom in this and did as Chuzi advised. When Khan took the city of Kaifeng after a long siege and decided to massacre its inhabitants, as he had in other cities that had resisted him, Chuzi told him that the finest craftsmen and engineers in China had fled to Kaifeng, and it would be better to put them to use. Kaifeng was spared. Never before had Genghis Khan shown such mercy. But then it wasn't really mercy that saved Kaifeng. Chuzi knew Khan well. He was a barbaric peasant who cared nothing for culture, or indeed for anything other than warfare and practical results. Chuzi chose to appeal to the only emotion that would work on such a man: greed. Self-interest is the lever that will move people. Once you can make them see how you can in some way meet their needs or advance their cause, their resistance to your requests for help will magically fall away. At each step on the way to acquiring power, you must train yourself to think your way inside the other person's mind, to see their needs and interests, to get rid of the screen of your own feelings that obscure the truth. Master this art, and there will be no limits to what you can accomplish. Reversal. Some people will see an appeal to their self-interest as ugly and ignoble. They actually prefer to be able to exercise charity, mercy, and justice, which are their ways of feeling superior to you. When you beg them for help, you emphasize their power and position. They are strong enough to need nothing from you except the chance to feel superior. This is the wine that intoxicates them. They are dying to fund your project, to introduce you to powerful people, provided, of course, that all this is done in public, and for a good cause. Usually the more public, the better. Not everyone, then, can be approached through cynical self-interest. Some people will be put off by it, because they don't want to seem to be motivated by such things. They need opportunities to display their good heart. Don't be shy. Give them that opportunity. It's not as if you are conning them by asking for help. It is really their pleasure to give and to be seen giving. You must distinguish the differences among powerful people and figure out what makes them tick. When they ooze greed, do not appeal to their charity. When they want to look charitable and noble, do not appeal to their greed. Here is a further reflection on this law. From Aesop's Fables. The Peasant and the Apple Tree. A peasant had in his garden an apple tree which bore no fruit, but only served as a perch for the sparrows and grasshoppers. He resolved to cut it down, and, taking his axe in hand, made a bold stroke at its roots. The grasshoppers and sparrows entreated him not to cut down the tree that sheltered them, but to spare it, and they would sing to him and lighten his labors. He paid no attention to their request, but gave the tree a second and third blow with his axe. When he reached the hollow of the tree, he found a hive full of honey. Having tasted the honeycomb, he threw down his axe, and looking on the tree as sacred, took great care of it. Self-interest alone moves some men. The 14th Law. Pose as a friend, work as a spy. Judgment. Knowing about your rival is critical. Use spies to gather valuable information that will keep you a step ahead. Better still, play the spy yourself. In polite social encounters, learn to probe. Ask indirect questions to get people to reveal their weaknesses and intentions. There is no occasion that is not an opportunity for artful spying. Observance of the law. Joseph Duveen was undoubtedly the greatest art dealer of his time. From 1904 to 1940, he almost single-handedly monopolized America's millionaire art-collecting market. But one prize plum eluded him, the industrialist Andrew Mellon. Before he died, Duveen was determined to make Mellon a client. Duveen's friend said this was an impossible dream. Mellon was a stiff, taciturn man. The stories he had heard about the congenial, talkative Duveen rubbed him the wrong way. He had made it clear he had no desire to meet the man. Yet Duveen told his doubting friends, "Not only will Mellon buy from me, but he will buy only from me." For several years he tracked his prey, learning the man's habits, tastes, phobias. To do this, he secretly put several of Mellon's staff on his own payroll, worming valuable information out of them. By the time he moved into action, he knew Mellon about as well as Mellon's wife did. In 1921, Mellon was visiting London. He stayed in a palatial suite on the third floor of Claridge's Hotel. Duveen booked himself into the suite just below Mellon's on the second floor. He had arranged for his valet to befriend Mellon's valet, and on the fateful day he had chosen to make his move, Mellon's valet told Duveen's valet, who told Duveen, that he had just helped Mellon on with his overcoat, and that the industrialist was making his way down the corridor to ring for the lift. Duveen's valet hurriedly helped Duveen with his own overcoat. Seconds later, Duveen entered the lift, and lo and behold, there was Mellon. "How do you do, Mr. Mellon?" said Duveen, introducing himself. "I am on my way to the National Gallery to look at some pictures." How uncanny. That was precisely where Mellon was headed. And so Duveen was able to accompany his prey to the one location that would ensure his success. He knew Mellon's taste inside and out, and while the two men wandered through the museum, he dazzled the magnate with his knowledge. Once again, quite uncannily, they seemed to have remarkably similar tastes. Mellon was pleasantly surprised. This was not the Duveen he had expected. The man was charming and agreeable, and clearly had exquisite taste. When they returned to New York, Mellon visited Duveen's exclusive gallery and fell in love with the collection. Everything, surprisingly enough, seemed to be precisely the kind of work he wanted to collect. For the rest of his life, he was Duveen's best and most generous client. Interpretation. A man as ambitious and competitive as Joseph Duveen left nothing to chance. What's the point of winging it, of just hoping you may be able to charm this or that client? It's like shooting ducks blindfolded. Arm yourself with a little knowledge, and your aim improves. Mellon was the most spectacular of Duveen's catches, but he spied on many a millionaire. By secretly putting members of his clients' household staffs on his own payroll, he would gain constant access to valuable information about their master's comings and goings, changes in taste, and other such tidbits of information that would put him a step ahead. A rival of Duveen's who wanted to make Henry Frick a client noticed that whenever he visited this wealthy New Yorker, Duveen was there before him, as if he had a sixth sense. To other dealers, Duveen seemed to be everywhere and to know everything before they did. His powers discouraged and disheartened them, until many simply gave up going after the wealthy clients who could make a dealer rich. Such is the power of artful spying. It makes you seem all-powerful, clairvoyant. Your knowledge of your mark can also make you seem charming. So well can you anticipate his desires. No one sees the source of your power. And what they cannot see, they cannot fight. As the Indian philosopher Kautilya said, "Rulers see through spies, as cows through smell, Brahmins through scriptures, and the rest of the people through their normal eyes." Keys to Power. In the realm of power, your goal is a degree of control over future events. Part of the problem you face, then, is that people won't tell you all their thoughts, emotions, and plans. Controlling what they say, they often keep the most critical parts of their character hidden. Their weaknesses, ulterior motives, obsessions. The result is that you cannot predict their moves and are constantly in the dark. The trick is to find a way to probe them, to find out their secrets and hidden intentions, without letting them know what you're up to. This is not as difficult as you might think. A friendly front will let you secretly gather information on friends and enemies alike. Let others consult the horoscope or read tarot cards. You have more concrete means of seeing into the future. The most common way of spying is to use other people, as Devin did. The method is simple, powerful, but risky. You will certainly gather information, but you have little control over the people who are doing the work. Perhaps they will ineptly reveal your spying, or even secretly turn against you. It is far better to be the spy yourself, to pose as a friend while secretly gathering information. The French politician Talleyrand was one of the greatest practitioners of this art. He had an uncanny ability to worm secrets out of people in polite conversation. A contemporary of his, Baron de Vitraux, wrote, "Wit and grace marked his conversation. He possessed the art of concealing his thoughts or his malice beneath a transparent veil of insinuations, words that imply something more than they express. Only when necessary did he inject his own personality." The key here is Talleyrand's ability to suppress himself in the conversation, to make others talk endlessly about themselves and inadvertently reveal their intentions and plans. Throughout Talleyrand's life, people said he was a superb conversationalist, yet he actually said very little. He never talked about his own ideas. He got others to reveal theirs. He would organize friendly games of charades for foreign diplomats, social gatherings where, however, he would carefully weigh their words, cajole confidences out of them, and gather information invaluable to his work as France's foreign minister. At the Congress of Vienna, 1814 to 1815, he did his spying in other ways. He would blurt out what seemed to be a secret, actually something he had made up, then watch his listeners' reactions. He might tell a gathering of diplomats, for instance, that a reliable source had revealed to him that the Tsar of Russia was planning to arrest his top general for treason. By watching the diplomats' reaction to this made-up story, he would know which ones were most excited by the weakening of the Russian army. Perhaps their governments had designs on Russia. As Baron von Stetten said, "Monsieur Talleyrand fires a pistol into the air to see who will jump out the window." During social gatherings and innocuous encounters, pay attention. This is when people's guards are down. By suppressing your own personality, you can make them reveal things. The brilliance of the maneuver is that they will mistake your interest in them for friendship, so that you not only learn, you make allies. Nevertheless, you should practice this tactic with caution and care. If people begin to suspect you are worming secrets out of them under the cover of conversation, they will strictly avoid you. Emphasize friendly chatter, not valuable information. Your search for gems of information cannot be too obvious, or your probing questions will reveal more about yourself and your intentions than about the information you hope to find. A trick to try in spying comes from La Rochefoucauld, who wrote, "Sincerity is found in very few men, and is often the cleverest of ruses. One is sincere in order to draw out the confidence and secrets of the other." By pretending to bare your heart to another person, in other words, you make them more likely to reveal their own secrets. Give them a false confession, and they will give you a real one. Another trick was identified by the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who suggested vehemently contradicting people you're in conversation with as a way of irritating them, stirring them up so that they lose some of the control over their words. In their emotional reaction, they will reveal all kinds of truths about themselves, truths you can later use against them. Another method of indirect spying is to test people, to lay little traps that make them reveal things about themselves. Khosroes II, a notoriously clever 7th-century king of the Persians, had many ways of seeing through his subjects without raising suspicion. If he noticed, for instance, that two of his courtiers had become particularly friendly, he would call one of them aside and say he had information that the other was a traitor and would soon be killed. The king would tell the courtier he trusted him more than anyone and that he must keep this information secret. Then he would watch the two men carefully. If he saw that the second courtier had not changed his behavior toward the king, he would conclude that the first courtier had kept the secret, and he would quickly promote the man, later taking him aside to confess, "I meant to kill your friend because of certain information that had reached me, but when I investigated the matter, I found it was untrue." If, on the other hand, the second courtier started to avoid the king, acting aloof and tense, Khosroes would know that the secret had been revealed. He would ban the second courtier from his court, letting him know that the whole business had only been a test, but that even though the man had done nothing wrong, he could no longer trust him. The first courtier, however, had revealed a secret, and him, Khosroes, would ban from his entire kingdom. It may seem an odd form of spying that reveals not empirical information, but a person's character. Often, however, it is the best way of solving problems before they arise. By tempting people into certain acts, you learn about their loyalty, their honesty, and so on. And this kind of knowledge is often the most valuable of all. Armed with it, you can predict their actions in the future. Reversal. Information is critical to power, but just as you spy on other people, you must be prepared for them to spy on you. One of the most potent weapons in the battle for information, then, is giving out false information. As Winston Churchill said, "Truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies." You must surround yourself with such a bodyguard, so that your truth cannot be penetrated. By planting the information of your choice, you control the game. In 1944, the Nazis' rocket bomb attacks on London suddenly escalated. Over 2,000 V-1 flying bombs fell on the city, killing more than 5,000 people and wounding many more. Somehow, however, the Germans consistently missed their targets. Bombs that were intended for Tower Bridge or Piccadilly would fall well short of the city, landing in the less populated suburbs. This was because, in fixing their targets, the Germans relied on secret agents they had planted in England. They did not know that these agents had been discovered and that in their place, English-controlled agents were feeding them subtly deceptive information. The bombs would hit farther and farther from their targets every time they fell. By the end of the campaign, they were landing on cows in the country. By feeding people wrong information, then, you gain a potent advantage. While spying gives you a third eye, disinformation puts out one of your enemy's eyes. A cyclops, he always misses his target. Here is a further reflection on this law, by Arthur Schopenhauer. If you have reason to suspect that a person is telling you a lie, look as though you believed every word he said. This will give him courage to go on. He will become more vehement in his assertions and, in the end, betray himself. Again, if you perceive that a person is trying to conceal something from you, but with only partial success, look as though you did not believe him. The opposition on your part will provoke him into leading out his reserve of truth and bringing the whole force of it to bear upon your incredulity. The 15th Law. Crush your enemy totally. Judgment. All great leaders since Moses have known that a feared enemy must be crushed completely. Sometimes they have learned this the hard way. If one ember is left alight, no matter how dimly it smolders, a fire will eventually break out. More is lost through stopping halfway than through total annihilation. The enemy will recover and will seek revenge. Crush him, not only in body, but in spirit. Transgression of the law. No rivalry between leaders is more celebrated in Chinese history than the struggle between Shang Yu and Liu Bang. These two generals began their careers as friends, fighting on the same side. Xiang Yu came from the nobility. Large and powerful, given to bouts of violence and temper, a bit dull-witted, he was yet a mighty warrior who always fought at the head of his troops. Liu Bang came from peasant stock. He had never been much of a soldier, and preferred women and wine to fighting. In fact, he was something of a scoundrel. But he was wily, and he had the ability to recognize the best strategists, keep them as his advisers, and listen to their advice. He had risen in the army through these strengths. In 208 BC, the king of Chu sent two massive armies to conquer the powerful kingdom of Qin. One army went north under the generalship of Sun Yi, with Shang Yu second in command. The other, led by Liu Pang, headed straight toward Qin. The target was the kingdom's splendid capital, Shangyang. And Shang Yu, ever violent and impatient, could not stand the idea that Liu Pang would get to Shangyang first, and perhaps would assume command of the entire army. At one point on the northern front, Shang's commander, Sun Yi, hesitated in sending his troops into battle. Furious, Shang entered Sun Yi's tent, proclaimed him a traitor, cut off his head, and assumed sole command of the army. Without waiting for orders, he left the northern front and marched directly on Shangyang. He felt certain he was the better soldier and general than Liu, but to his utter astonishment, his rival, leading a smaller, swifter army, managed to reach Shangyang first. Shang had an advisor, Fon Seng, who warned him, "This village headman, Liu Bang, used to be greedy only for riches and women. But since entering the capital, he has not been led astray by wealth, wine, or sex. That shows he is aiming high." Fon Seng urged Shang to kill his rival before it was too late. He told the general to invite the wily peasant to a banquet at their camp outside Shangyang, and, in the midst of a celebratory sword dance, to have his head cut off. The invitation was sent. Liu fell for the trap and came to the banquet. But Shang hesitated in ordering the sword dance, and by the time he gave the signal, Liu had sensed a trap and managed to escape. "Bah!" cried Fon Seng in disgust, seeing that Xiang had botched the plot. "One cannot plan with a simpleton. Liu Bang will steal your empire yet, and make us all his prisoners." Realizing his mistake, Shang hurriedly marched on Shangyang, this time determined to hack off his rival's head. Liu was never one to fight when the odds were against him, and he abandoned the city. Shang captured Shangyang, murdered the young prince of Qin, and burned the city to the ground. Liu was now Shang's bitter enemy, and he pursued him for many months, finally cornering him in a walled city. Lacking food, his army in disarray, Liu sued for peace. Again Fon Seng warned Shang, "Crush him now! If you let him go again, you will be sorry later." But Shang decided to be merciful. He wanted to bring Liu back to Chu alive, and to force his former friend to acknowledge him as master. But Fan proved right. Liu managed to use the negotiations for his surrender as a distraction, and he escaped with a small army. Shang, amazed that he had yet again let his rival slip away, once more set out after Liu, this time with such ferocity that he seemed to have lost his mind. At one point, having captured Liu's father in battle, Shang stood the old man up during the fighting and yelled to Liu across the line of troops, "Surrender now, or I shall boil your father alive." Liu calmly answered, "But we are sworn brothers, so my father is your father also. If you insist on boiling your own father, send me a bowl of the soup." Shang backed down, and the struggle continued. A few weeks later, in the thick of the hunt, Shang scattered his forces unwisely, and in a surprise attack, Liu was able to surround his main garrison. For the first time, the tables were turned. Now it was Xiang who sued for peace. Liu's top advisor urged him to destroy Xiang, crush his army, show no mercy. "To let him go would be like rearing a tiger. It will devour you later," the advisor said. Liu agreed. Making a false treaty, he lured Xiang into relaxing his defense, then slaughtered almost all of his army. Xiang managed to escape, Alone and on foot, knowing that Leo had put a bounty on his head, he came upon a small group of his own retreating soldiers and cried out, "I hear Liu Peng has offered 1,000 pieces of gold and a fief of 10,000 families for my head. Let me do you a favor." Then he slit his own throat and died. Interpretation. Shang Yu had proven his ruthlessness on many an occasion. He rarely hesitated in doing away with a rival if it served his purposes. But with Liu Bang he acted differently. He respected his rival. He did not want to defeat him through deception. He wanted to prove his superiority on the battlefield, even to force the clever Liu to surrender and to serve him. Every time he had his rival in his hands, something made him hesitate. A fatal sympathy with, or respect for, the man who, after all, had once been a friend and comrade in arms. But the moment Shang made it clear that he intended to do away with Liu, yet failed to accomplish it, he sealed his own doom. Liu would not suffer the same hesitation once the tables were turned. This is the fate that faces all of us when we sympathize with our enemies, when pity or the hope of reconciliation makes us pull back from doing away with them. We only strengthen their fear and hatred of us. We have beaten them and they are humiliated. Yet we nurture these resentful vipers who will one day kill us. Power cannot be dealt with this way. It must be exterminated, crushed, and denied the chance to return to haunt us. This is all the truer with a former friend who has become an enemy. The law governing fatal antagonisms reads, "Reconciliation is out of the question. Only one side can win, and it must win totally." Liu Bang learned this lesson well. After defeating Shang Yu, this son of a farmer went on to become supreme commander of the armies of Chu. Crushing his next rival, the king of Chu, his own former leader, he crowned himself emperor, defeated everyone in his path, and went down in history as one of the greatest rulers of China. The immortal Han Gaozu, founder of the Han Dynasty. As Cortelia said, "Those who seek to achieve things should show no mercy." Observance of the Law. Wu Zhao, born in 625 A.D., was the daughter of a duke, and as a beautiful young woman of many charms, she was accordingly attached to the harem of Emperor Taizong. The imperial harem was a dangerous place, full of young concubines vying to become the emperor's favorite. Wu's beauty and forceful character quickly won her this battle, but knowing that the emperor, like other powerful men, is a creature of whim, and that she could easily be replaced, she kept her eye on the future. Wu managed to seduce the emperor's dissolute son, Gaozong, on the only possible occasion when she could find him alone, while he was relieving himself at the royal urinal. Even so, when the emperor died and Gaozong took over the throne, she still suffered the fate to which all wives and concubines of a deceased emperor were bound by tradition and law. Her head shaven, she entered a convent for what was supposed to be the rest of her life. For 7 years, Wu schemed to escape. By communicating in secret with the new emperor, and by befriending his wife, the empress, she managed to get a highly unusual royal edict, allowing her to return to the palace and to the royal harem. Once there, she fawned on the empress, while still sleeping with the emperor. The empress didn't discourage this. She had yet to provide the emperor with an heir. Her position was vulnerable, and Wu was a valuable ally. In 654, Wu Zhao gave birth to a child. One day the empress came to visit, and as soon as she had left, Wu smothered the newborn, her own baby. When the murder was discovered, suspicion immediately fell on the empress, who had been on the scene moments earlier and whose jealous nature was known by all. This was precisely Wu's plan. Shortly thereafter, the empress was charged with murder and executed. Wu Zhao was crowned empress in her place. Her new husband, addicted to his life of pleasure, gladly gave up the reins of government to Wu Zhao, who was from then on known as Empress Wu. Although now in a position of great power, Wu hardly felt secure. There were enemies everywhere. She could not let down her guard for one moment. Indeed, when she was 41, she began to fear that her beautiful young niece was becoming the emperor's favorite. She poisoned the woman with a clay mixed into her food. In 675, her own son, touted as the heir apparent, was poisoned as well. The next eldest son, illegitimate but now the crown prince, was exiled a little later on trumped-up charges. And when the emperor died in 683, Wu managed to have the son after that declared unfit for the throne. All this meant that it was her youngest, most ineffectual son who finally became emperor. In this way, she continued to rule. Over the next 5 years, there were innumerable palace coups. All of them failed, and all of the conspirators were executed. By 688, there was no one left to challenge Wu. She proclaimed herself a divine descendant of Buddha, and in 690, her wishes were finally granted. She was named Holy and Divine Emperor of China. Wu became emperor because there was literally nobody left from the previous Tang Dynasty. And so she ruled unchallenged for over a decade of relative peace. In 705, at the age of 80, she was forced to abdicate. Interpretation. All who knew Empress Wu remarked on her energy and intelligence. At the time, there was no glory available for an ambitious woman beyond a few years in the imperial harem, then a lifetime walled up in a convent. In Wu's gradual but remarkable rise to the top, she was never naive. She knew any hesitation, any momentary weakness would spell her end. If, every time she got rid of a rival, a new one appeared, the solution was simple. She had to crush them all or be killed herself. Other emperors before her had followed the same path to the top, but Wu, who as a woman had next to no chance to gain power, had to be more ruthless still. Empress Wu's 40-year reign was one of the longest in Chinese history. Although the story of her bloody rise to power is well known, in China she is considered one of the period's most able and effective rulers. A priest asked the dying Spanish statesman and general Ramon Maria Narvaez, 1800-1868, "Does your excellency forgive all your enemies?"
"I do not have to forgive my enemies," answered Narvaez. "I have had them all shut."
Keys to power. It is no accident that the two stories illustrating this law come from China. Chinese history abounds with examples of enemies who were left alive and returned to haunt the lenient. Crush the enemy is a key strategic tenet of Sun Tzu, the 4th century BC author of The Art of War. The idea is simple. Your enemies wish you ill. There is nothing they want more than to eliminate you. If in your struggles with them you stop halfway, or even three-quarters of the way, out of mercy or hope of reconciliation, you will only make them more determined, more embittered, and they will someday take revenge. They may act friendly for the time being, but this is only because you have defeated them. They have no choice but to bide their time. The solution? Have no mercy. Crush your enemies as totally as they would crush you. Ultimately, the only peace and security you can hope for from your enemies is their disappearance. Mao Zedong, a devoted reader of Sun Tzu and of Chinese history generally, knew the importance of this law. In 1934, the communist leader and some 75,000 poorly equipped soldiers fled into the desolate mountains of western China to escape Chiang Kai-shek's much larger army, in what has since been called the Long March. Chiang was determined to eliminate every last communist, and by a few years later, Mao had less than 10,000 soldiers left. By 1937, in fact, when China was invaded by Japan, Chiang calculated that the communists were no longer a threat. He chose to give up the chase and concentrate on the Japanese. 10 years later, the communists had recovered enough to rout Chiang's army. Chiang had forgotten the ancient wisdom of crushing the enemy. Mao had not. Chiang was pursued until he and his entire army fled to the island of Taiwan. Nothing remains of his regime in mainland China to this day. The wisdom behind crushing the enemy is as ancient as the Bible. Its first practitioner may have been Moses, who learned it from God himself, when he parted the Red Sea for the Jews, then let the water flow back over the pursuing Egyptians so that not so much as one of them remained. When Moses returned from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and found his people worshiping the golden calf, he had every last offender slaughtered. And just before he died, he told his followers, finally about to enter the Promised Land, that when they had defeated the tribes of Canaan, they should utterly destroy them, make no covenant with them, and show no mercy to them. The goal of total victory is an axiom of modern warfare, and was codified as such by Karl von Clausewitz, the premier philosopher of war. Analyzing the campaigns of Napoleon, von Clausewitz wrote, "We do claim that direct annihilation of the enemy's forces must always be the dominant consideration. Once a major victory is achieved, there must be no talk of rest, of breathing space, but only of the pursuit, going for the enemy again, seizing his capital, attacking his reserves, and anything else that might give his country aid and comfort." The reason for this is that after war come negotiation and the division of territory. If you have only won a partial victory, you will inevitably lose in negotiation what you have gained by war. The solution is simple. Allow your enemies no options. Annihilate them, and their territory is yours to carve. The goal of power is to control your enemies completely, to make them obey your will. You cannot afford to go halfway. If they have no options, they will be forced to do your bidding. This law has applications far beyond the battlefield. Negotiation is the insidious viper that will eat away at your victory. So give your enemies nothing to negotiate, no hope, no room to maneuver. They are crushed, and that is that. Realize this. In your struggle for power, you will stir up rivalries and create enemies. There will be people you cannot win over, who will remain your enemies no matter what. But whatever wound you inflicted on them, deliberately or not, do not take their hatred personally. Just recognize that there is no possibility of peace between you, especially as long as you stay in power. If you let them stick around, they will seek revenge as certainly as night follows day. To wait for them to show their cards is just silly. As Empress Wu understood, by then it will be too late. Be realistic. With an enemy like this around, you will never be secure. Remember the lessons of history and the wisdom of Moses and Mao. Never go halfway. It is not, of course, a question of murder. It is a question of banishment. Sufficiently weakened and then exiled from your court forever, your enemies are rendered harmless. They have no hope of recovering, insinuating themselves, and hurting you. And if they cannot be banished, at least understand that they are plotting against you and pay no heed to whatever friendliness they feign. Your only weapon in such a situation is your own wariness. If you cannot banish them immediately, then plot for the best time to act. Reversal. This law should very rarely be ignored, but it does sometimes happen that it is better to let your enemies destroy themselves, if such a thing is possible, than to make them suffer by your hand. In warfare, for example, a good general knows that if he attacks an army when it is cornered, its soldiers will fight much more fiercely. It is sometimes better, then, to leave them an escape route, a way out. As they retreat, they wear themselves out, and are ultimately more demoralized by the retreat than by any defeat he might inflict on the battlefield. When you have someone on the ropes, then, but only when you are sure they have no chance of recovery, you might let them hang themselves. Let them be the agents of their own destruction. The result will be the same, and you won't feel half as bad. Finally, sometimes by crushing an enemy, you embitter them so much that they spend years and years plotting revenge. The Treaty of Versailles had such an effect on the Germans. Some would argue that in the long run, it would be better to show some leniency. The problem is your leniency involves another risk. It may embolden the enemy, which still harbors a grudge, but now has some room to operate. It is almost always wiser to crush your enemy. If they plot revenge years later, do not let your guard down, but simply crush them again. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Kautilya, Indian philosopher. The remnants of an enemy can become active like those of a disease or fire. Hence, these should be exterminated completely.
One should never ignore an enemy, knowing him to be weak. He becomes dangerous in